Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is Dr. Simeon Roger, and welcome to this very special audio as part of the Cancer Files. Tonight we have a very special guest, and I'm going to be talking to him about some things that are going to rock your world, some things to do directly with healing and preventing cancer. And through his personal work with over 20,000 trauma survivors, our special guest has developed innovative strategies for unlocking our innate power to free ourselves from the constraints of the past in order to live fully in the present. Trained as an archaeologist, a Catholic priest, an addictions counselor, clinical hypnotherapist, and trauma specialist, this gifted therapist and teacher developed holographic memory resolution, or HMR, a process for empowering us to release trauma and the obstacles to authentic spiritual intimacy and conscious manifestation. The effectiveness of his body-centered, client-centered approach led to his involvement with the rescue personnel from the Oklahoma City bombing, the crisis team members from TWA Flight 800 in New York, survivors and rescue personnel from the September 11th terrorist attacks in 2001, and those impacted by Hurricane Katrina. He is one of a select group of alternative health practitioners at the Miraval Life in Balance and maintains a private practice in Tucson, Arizona. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Brent Baum. Brent, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Simeon. Glad to be here with you.
Now, Brent, I know a lot about your background, personally, of course, because I've read one of your two books, Light, Living as Light, which, by the way, I highly recommend to people. Living as Light, The Awakening of Mystical Consciousness, is an absolute masterpiece. I totally love it and would highly endorse that for anybody. So if you're listening to this, please consider reading that book. But because I know so much about your background and we know each other personally, but for everybody else's benefit, of course, I need to ask you, how did someone who began training as an archaeologist and a Catholic priest end up doing something as unique as what you're doing now?
Well, that's a bit of a story here, and I call it funny thing happened on the way to the Jesuits, actually, is my part of my tale here. But I was trained as a Catholic priest and had a great education. But prior to that, even in my family, I'm from Louisiana, my mother was quite an empathic person. And though we were Catholic Louisiana, very traditionally trained, had a great education, majored in theology in college, was the top graduate in my major field, had already trained in a lot of theology, and then was sent to Rome to try to strengthen my education by a bishop that was very supportive at the time, was trained to write and teach, and then the bishop died of congestive heart failure, and I wasn't going to have an opportunity to write and teach. The views of the value of my training changed. And they decided that it would be better if I was active in parish work for about 8 years and then maybe taught, at which point I said, after 8 years, I'm not sure I'll remember the languages any longer. Took a leave of absence, actually planning to join the Jesuits and train. I had been invited, actually, to consider training in archaeology because I had done archaeology for almost 13 years and loved the hands-on contact in Israel. And before I had a chance to go there, a series of events occurred. I had considered training in counseling with my background. I had always loved the counseling field and had a personal interest in addictions, not because we had any addictive family members, but because we always seemed to attract and marry addicts in my family. And even my religious system, the first pastor I was stationed to live with had some issues with alcohol, and the bishop, first bishop of my diocese died of cirrhosis of the liver. So my religious system seemed to be more alcoholic than my family system, but I enjoyed the addictions model because it had a spirituality component or an aspect to it. And so I began to get certified, decided not to travel as an itinerant teacher right away, and got certified in addictions. But because I wasn't chemically dependent, I was placed as the head of the mental health services department for two different outpatient centers, one for actually a Catholic hospital and the other owned by a number of psychiatrists. But not being chemically dependent, they decided it would be better if I was placed working with the traumatized family members, at which point I expressed a little bit of frustration because I was not really trained at that point in trauma. And that is mostly what I was dealing with. And at that time, came across the work of a psychologist from New Zealand named David Grove, who made a little discovery that I think changes the psychopathology model in the end and certainly changed my life and the 42 therapists I now have trained in this technique also, about 1,500 to 2,000 in training right now. And what he discovered, David Grove discovered, was that the nervous system and the body-mind always pauses consciousness at the millisecond before you're overwhelmed. And he called that T-1, trauma minus a millisecond. And in the outpatient work with the traumatized family members of addicts, I noticed that many of them were reliving certain moments over and over again. Even talking about it every few weeks, it would come back up again and seemed as though it was still fully charged. So I actually developed my work and techniques as a spin-off of his work as an attempt at relapse prevention to try to keep family members from going into depression, anxiety, and many of the family members of addicts died sooner, and talking about cancers, died sooner than the addicts. They did develop. I think there were some studies in Australia of women and spouses of alcoholics and addicts who, because they're carrying all the stress and compensating for the addict's dysfunction, many of them developed illnesses and breast cancers. And in our addictions training, they spoke to us frequently about how the immune systems of the co-addict were profoundly impacted by the stress of living with addiction and weakened and therefore resulted in breast cancer. The psychiatrist that I worked with at one of the Catholic hospitals did her residency on women with breast cancer, and I asked if there was a common factor. And she said, oh, many of them were spouses or married to, at one point in time, abusive alcoholics. And being somewhat codependent and repressing their emotions, it seemed to manifest rather readily as some form of cancer.
And that's interesting because the research that we did for the Cancer Files did turn up the fact that emotional repression seemed to be a vital ingredient almost in the development of certain types of cancer, breast cancer in particular.
That is certainly what I've heard and seen in my own research and work as well. So, yes, I would completely concur on that. And from my own experience, when I do lectures, if I ask how many have had breast cancer and then happen to chat with them about, you know, their relationship histories behind this, and they'll talk about an abusive relationship quite frequently, maybe the majority even. Although we don't hold, you know, you can work with the one client that does not have that as the cause. But in general, sure. You're absolutely right. There is certainly an emotional factor contributing to, I think, the majority of cases. And so I developed the techniques based on Grove's work, which I refer to as an emotional reframing technique, because it's really about what we find is that when we take that picture, and my work is a fusion of what they're now calling somatic psychology, energy psychology, and maybe color psychology as well. It's about the using your own brainwave frequencies in a very simple way to try to restore balance when you froze a scene of trauma. And I guess we'd say somatic psychology, we understand now that the body takes that picture at the millisecond prior to overwhelm. And to this day, scientists don't know quite how we image. They know that it's hologram-like. The technical term for memory now is holonomic, that it acts like a three-dimensional hologram. We also know that we pause the millisecond prior to overwhelm. That was Grove's contribution. And that when, and psychology has taught this for years, that when we pause consciousness, it creates what they refer to as state-bound memory or state-dependent memory. And from SPECT scans of the brain, we now know, of course, that when we take that picture, we don't just freeze the visual imagery, we freeze all of our sensory data and create a situation where our physiology is literally bound at that moment to that state of consciousness. So that when we relive memories, the problem with memory is that it brings up the original physiology. And how I got into this field with the energy component is that my mother was an empathic person who could feel when we were in accidents and injuries, would feel a physical pain in her body, would know which child was injured, would write the time down, wait for you to call. And in 1983, when she died, I sat upright in bed in Rome, Italy, at the moment she passed away, and I felt it physically. And then about a decade later, working with a client in 1992, discovered that when they went into memory, and I had my hands placed near her head at the time, I had done some training and energy techniques for stress reduction and release and was doing a little bit of energy work at that time. My great uncle on my mother's side could do some hands-on healing with headaches and fever blisters and some small viral things. I discovered in 92 that I could do that as well, having healed myself with some little warts and found I could release my headaches and some pain sites. And I was doing that technique. She knew my sister, so I was trying to do that technique with her in 1992. And she asked me to work on her migraine before we began therapy that day so that she could stay for the group therapy. And when I placed my hands near her head, it started to go away and then came back stronger, and it turned out to be a memory. When she went into memory, my hands went into pretty intense pain. As the memory got more active, the pain increased. And when she accessed the moment of abuse, the pain became very, very sharp. And when she used the technique, which we'll talk about in a bit, she actually used the corrected image, moved it through her body as a color frequency. And when she did that, I felt a flash of pain, the waves started releasing, and her migraine was gone in about 3 minutes. And I felt the waves release from her head. Not being sure that every person could do the same thing, I applied the same, you know, my hands near other sensations, headaches, migraines, neck pain, back pain, whiplash, car accidents. So when clients went into those pains, I could also feel the sensation arise. And when they used the technique effectively, I could feel a discharge from the body. So I knew that we were capable then of emotionally reframing these kinds of traumatic events and inserting what I now call proof of safety. That really the challenge for most trauma survivors is not changing history, but talking to both the cells and the neurons and the meridians of the body both, because I think consciousness is stored both in the physical body and the blueprint or the meridians. In fact, as you know, if we lose the organ or the limb, if the memory is intact, we have the phantom pain or holographic memory of the pain intact from the memory. So we know we at least have to talk to consciousness as well as the body now. We're finally learning that. And when this technique spoke to that particular moment of encoding and proved safety, the body released the pain. So I discovered in 92 that emotional reframing could in fact release the charge of memory, and then it did not come up again. That majority of cases, unless it was part of a larger trauma pattern, or we did fear one day and anger came up as part two in a subsequent session, that once it was reframed, generally the pattern did not return. It did not come back. They remembered the event, but there was no emotional charge. And then as far as cancer goes, the side effect was, the shock was, I developed it as a relapse prevention technique for addictions and family members. But when we started doing the reframing, migraines, neck pain, whiplash, back pain, certain cancers, when people reframed the memories, we found that the state-bound memory released, and if the illness or disease was memory-based, that when we resolve the state-bound memory, one of the things we know now is that when a trauma memory is encoded at T-1, the moment of freezing, adrenaline goes up. Fight, flight, freeze follows it immediately. And when adrenaline rises, your T-cell and your immune system weaken. And, of course, they estimate now. Yes.
Yeah, sorry, just to stop you right there for a minute. So what we're really saying here is just a couple of quick questions. One is when we talk about trauma, you're talking about, I take it, both physical and emotional trauma, and I realize they're not completely separate, but really it could be either or a combination.
Absolutely. So when physical pain becomes frightening or overwhelming, that is your trauma state, that it overwhelms you, frightens you, and that's where your limbic system is going to, limbic, hypothalamic, pituitary, adrenal axis will kick in, your fight, flight, freeze to also protect you.
So trauma is inextricably linked with fight or flight and the weakening of the immune system.
Yes. In fact, some would say, though, that like Rosalind Bruyere was able to predict a flashback coming up before the physiological indicators showed up. So it would suggest that consciousness is paused first, and then the body-mind follows suit protectively with fight, flight, freeze, maybe within a millisecond or even less. But it is
it is
closely bound.
If someone has an unresolved trauma then, and something triggers that memory, in that case, if you were to have the person hooked up to the appropriate instruments, it would probably register chemically and through other body, the usual body signs, fight or flight would be obvious. It would come up right away.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
a racing heartbeat.
They go into defensive physiology, basically.
Right. We did some measurements with biofeedback instruments, and when the memory starts to surface, you get increased heart rate, you know, respiratory changes, the approach holding of the breath, heightened anxiety, tension, muscle tension, galvanic skin response. It's quite noticeable. And then as soon as the memory is reframed with this technique, using the clients on visual image for safety and transmitting that, usually using our primary language, the child language of color. What color frame do you see around the corrected image, or what color do you see from the scene that captures your attention? Let's move that through the site in your body where you're holding the original icon of tension. And when you do that, basically the body normalizes. So the adrenals say, oh, we're not in fight, flight, freeze, we're not in danger. The adrenals go down, and at that moment, your thymus cell production, your T cell production, then goes up significantly, almost skyrockets. It's like most of my major coordinators for this technique, for instance, are former fibromyalgia sufferers. And I'm not a physician, I'm not a specialist in fibromyalgia, but when they did their memory work and started reframing all of their memories, stress, small T trauma, big T trauma, anything on the continuum, they went into remission. So majority of my coordinators are former fibromyalgia sufferers who, you know, working with so many memories, impacted those 13 different variables that are used in the diagnosis of fibromyalgia.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And
not surprising you're getting that result with fibromyalgia in a sense.
No, and, you know, they're so generous with autoimmune labels these days. You know, we have everything, carpal tunnel, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel. When physician I visited, telling him I was having stomach pain, diagnosed me with irritable bowel in about probably 120 seconds and wrote a prescription. I was appalled by the whole thing and refused to go back to that individual again, the HMO. But I do not have irritable bowel, you know, but they're catch diagnoses for things that in the past, if we haven't been able to talk to the body efficiently and ask it why it's in pain, and allow it to map for us its history of pain, then what we ended up doing is deductively coming up with labels to try to give people a method of treatment and to categorize their pain, because we didn't know how to talk to T-1. We didn't know how to talk to the precise moment of encoding. We could do an entire show just on depression, where most people that are depressed have histories of depression, and we've never spoken efficiently to the moment of freezing for the abuse moments about that led them to the depression. Most people have reasons to be depressed if the trauma memories that I found have been unresolved. Same thing with a lot of the autoimmune disorders. Where it occurs in your body is often the somatic site where the icon is stored from trauma, and where the body is crying out for help. This is where you were traumatized. Hello, pay attention to me. The drugs people choose. As an addictions counselor, I frequently talk about the drug a person is attracted to is frequently related to where in the body they're holding the trauma pattern. Quick example would be like with teenagers with domestic violence, where they have nightmares, recurrent nightmares from the domestic violence, and anxiety in one of the three largest nerve plexes, the stomach and gut area. Well, their drug of choice is naturally going to be marijuana, because it induces black sleep, stops the nightmare, and calms the gut plexus. In fact, gives them the munchies. And they use it for cancer patients for nausea. So the drugs people are drawn to frequently relate to where in the body they're holding the anxiety and tension from a specific event.
That's amazing, even though they themselves, in most cases, are probably consciously not aware of that.
Exactly. Although I had one young man say, yeah, man, you know, when I smoke pot, it just makes the nightmare stop and it makes my dreams go black. And it's called black sleep by those that are familiar with the field and how they're using that. Your ADD person is going to be attracted to stimulants, but you use cocaine and it's not going to be like Ritalin or Adderall. You know, you're going to be highly addicted in a very short amount of time. And they slow down on cocaine, the ADD person. But they feel normal for a few weeks, completely normal, might even go to straight A's in school for a while. So, you know, we're drawn to the substances that affect the nerve centers of the body where we hold our trauma. I'm doing a lot of work in mapping out sites where memories are occurring in the body. I've developed a software program because the hallmark of my work is that if you ask the body, it will give you a series of memories that are contributing to the cancer or the weakening of the immune system. The body actually will talk to you and give you a series of circumstances or events that led to the development of a certain pathology or diagnosis.
So really, in your view then, and from what you've seen and experienced, the body or the body-mind organism, however you want to put it, really does have all this information and in a sense is more than willing to give it up, but we do have to know how to ask, somewhat like what happens with applied kinesiology or muscle testing.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I mean, there are other sources, many sources of cancers, for instance. My father worked for a petrochemical company, you know, Ethyl Corporation in Baton Rouge, was exposed to a colon cancer-causing agent. When we went to ask about the test, when the cancer showed up, oh, we're sorry, we can't find the test. The last one seems to be missing. Well, I'm pretty sure it was positive, and they had not informed him of that sooner. But either way, he ended up with a colostomy for 26 years from a colon cancer, and did survive that, but was clearly from an environmental exposure.
Yeah.
There are genetic causes, of course, contributors to. But my focus has been what can we shift in terms of memory, and even if we boost your immune system indirectly by just working on all of your trauma memories and stressors, if we can reduce the overall load of trauma in the body and bring the adrenals down, often the T cells will skyrocket or go up significantly and help to deal with any form of pathology, be it cancer or otherwise.
Yeah, this is amazing, and it's very exciting stuff. Maybe right now, though, might be the time to, if you can, just to clarify for everybody who's listening, what an HMR treatment is like. How does holographic memory resolution actually work?
Okay, well, you know, we discovered this actually with children. If you have a child, for instance, draw a picture of physical or sexual abuse, they'll almost always go to the two primary colors will be black and red. No love, no light, no safety, black. Minimal anger, violence, red. And that's fairly consistent. And color is our first language. I call it a primary language because it preceded words. And color, interestingly enough, is an infinite language, an infinite number of reds, an infinite number of greens and blues, whereas we only have a couple of words for reds, crimson, brick red, fire engine red, things of that sort. We have certain words for reds, but there's an infinite continuum of just reds, greens, blues, yellows, and everything in between. So color, in fact, to the brain is a fairly infinite language. So what we discovered is if you have a little child, and every color, by the way, can have a positive or a negative value. Black is calm, elegant, absolute, authoritative. Red is power, passion, energy, imperial colors of China and Japan. But when drawn for trauma, black is no light, no safety. Red is minimal, anger, violence. If you then have the child redraw the picture, which is what I do with adults also, recast the scene or redraw the picture the way it should have been, they'll automatically go to their bright, nurturing colors. If you then have them close their eyes and move a color or feeling, because all memories are holographic or holonomic, meaning every fragment contains the whole thing, a color, sound, feeling, breath, sensation from the positive scene moved through the part of the body holding the original icon of tension, in physics, you know, if you take red and black and you add all the missing colors that should have been there, so that positive color from the safe scene containing the whole value moved through the part of the body holding the red and black, and when you put all the colors back together at the same site, in physics, what you get is white light. So we're not at all changing your history. We're simply sending a signal from your own nervous system to your body to establish proof of safety. And when we do that and you put all the colors back together, it neutralizes the charge of the memory, proves safety at the site, and the body discharges then that state-bound memory or the attachment to the memory. And when I'm near a client with the gift from my mother is that when the client reframes correctly, I will feel the pain waves leave, and almost always I'll feel the body heat up, especially along the spine near C7, which is an easy access point to the dorsal channel, which handles all the neurotransmitters, pain neurotransmitters.
Right.
I found that point.
C7 being the prominent vertebrae just below the neck.
Correct. And I found that point in 94, scanning a client kind of accidentally one day, and I couldn't resolve the pain there because it was actually not a single memory. I found the primary access point, placed a hand there eventually in 94. I was the clinical director and then the trauma program coordinator for Cottonwood Treatment Centers, both in New Mexico and then eventually when they merged here in Tucson. And when I found that point in 94, I went and placed a hand on that site and sent a little bit of energy into it. In Arizona, you can place one hand, don't move it. That would be a massage. So anyway, placed one hand at that point and sent a little energy into that point. When I did, half of my clients went into an alpha theta, a REM, what looked like a REM state, but they're fully conscious. So it's actually referred to as an alpha theta brainwave state. So you're relaxed, conscious, and observing, but you're able to see and access the details of memory enough to find T-1 and reframe it without having to relive the event, which is what every treatment center was seeking. We don't want to destabilize the addicted client. We don't want to make them abreact or relive. They're going to relapse. So if they could stay calm but still see the memory and reframe it and insert the corrected emotional charge and proof of safety, then they always left the session calmer. And Dr. Jim Kowal in Naperville, Illinois, who's begun, is going to be doing some more measurements for us, has found that at the end of a session, the client leaves calmer than when they began the session. And for a single session, for a technique to produce that kind of result is almost unheard of, for it to occur that quickly.
Just to clarify then, unless I misunderstood, what you're doing is you're starting, almost starting the session with sending energy to C7 in order to induce the kind of calm state that enables you to find the origin of the memory?
Right. I mean, that is an option. You know, I do the sessions on the phone sometimes, although I prefer to work with you in person initially. I want to make sure a client is not dissociative or has some any other kinds of complications. If they're already in a life-threatening situation, I won't begin on the telephone. I'll refer them preferably to a local practitioner who does this or something comparable. But the technique is primarily what you do on your own. So I'm having the client see where they froze, find the moment of freezing, visualize what should have happened, and what I usually say is, what color frame do you see around the corrected image? And my archaeology work was actually quite helpful in that. I spent one summer studying with NASA, studying thermal infrared multispectral scanners. And what we discovered from that was that every form of matter has a unique fingerprint. Therefore, you, with your body perceptions, your nervous system, your nerve plexus, all these different energies and frequencies contributing to this imaging process, that when you freeze that movie or process internally, when you freeze the holographic projection system, that's a very unique image. Now, the child takes all that complex data and puts it into a black or red. When you have them redraw it, the child simply consolidates it into a positive color. Then when they move that color through the body, we found that the child calmed down immediately, was no longer anxious. They remembered the event, but they weren't emotionally triggered by it. There was no longer an emotional attachment to the memory.
Right. In other words, they're completely free at that point.
Exactly. So you can remember the event without triggering the adrenal response, the fight, flight, freeze reaction. So that is the goal, and that's what we hope to prove in the research in the next few years. I've been spending 7 years developing the research tool to document the exact memory sequencing, the sites in the body, where the memories are occurring. And then we want Dr. Kowal to help us with the three-dimensional EEGs and to show preferably the adrenal response, the changes and the drop in adrenaline overproduction that comes with the reframing of the memories.
Well, this brings up for me something analogous that might be of interest to you, and just a parallel for everybody who's listening, which is there is in the Taoist longevity tradition, there is a meditation system based on color. And the colors are associated with particular organ systems in the body. And this is fairly well known among practitioners of Chinese medicine because each, classically, as you probably know, each organ system is associated with one of the five elements in the Chinese system.
Right.
And so each organ has a particular color association. But when you do this particular meditation, you essentially draw in white light into the body, but you draw it into particular organs, and when it comes to that organ, the organ glows with its natural corresponding color, which in the case of the heart and the small intestine is red for the fire element.
Mm-hmm,
in the case
mm-hmm.
of the lungs and the large intestine, it's white for the metal element. In the case of the liver and the gallbladder, it's green for the wood element. in the case of the spleen, the stomach, and some would say the pancreas, it's yellow for the earth element. And then finally, in the case of the kidney system, which includes the reproductive organs as well as the urinary bladder, it's either a black or a dark blue for the water element.
Interesting.
Certainly what I found from doing this meditation is that it is immensely calming to the entire system.
Absolutely, and I haven't specifically done that piece. It's fortunate maybe they've already taken care of that. I don't have to worry about the organs. What I've been mapping is the physical, muscular, and structural site values for trauma and what it means when a trauma occurs in a different part of the body.
Yeah.
One of the big breakthroughs that I think researchers will be interested in is that about 5 years ago, scanning my clients as I was getting more sensitive, I noticed two meridians over the heart. Now, from ancient times, as you know from the text, the heart is described as the seat of decision-making. I just took that not very seriously and said, oh, well, your brain is where you make your decisions from. I don't know what this organ, the heart, would have anything to do with. But lo and behold, as I got energy sensitive, I noticed when people talked about the fact that their father left when they were 3 days old and came back when they were 3 and a half, there was an ice-cold spot along the left side of the chest, the right side of the heart, a meridian that was ice-cold, about 3/4 of an inch long. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. And as they talked about it and we reframed the memory, I could feel that leave or change. If there was a death or loss with mother at about 5, I felt it on the meridian to the left of the heart. So I started documenting memories and noticing where they were occurring and discovered that in the Orient they talk about, in the more esoteric circles, they'll talk about inner meridians and the fact that the heart has two meridians which store your relationship history.
Mm.
And on the right side is the male relationship history from conception to present day. And on the left side of the heart is the female, or more, I say feminine, because your mother could be more masculine and be on the right, single parent, and father could be on the left. But in general, the masculine meridian towards the right of the heart, the female on the left. I'm putting that into my new book that I'm working on, actually, Surviving Trauma School Earth. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about heart meridians, but where I'm finding it fascinating and talking with breast cancer patients is there a correlation? Because often it's the left breast, majority of the time, it's the left breast over the heart where the breast cancer occurs. Is there a correlation between the site of the tumor and a possible trauma along these meridians? And that question has never been addressed publicly by anyone to my knowledge. I'm not even sure that people are aware that these meridians exist. But when people talk about the law of attraction, why do I keep attracting emotionally unavailable men in my life? They say, is it tattooed on my forehead? And my answer is, no, I'm sorry, it's worse. It's actually over your heart. And your heart meridians are 50 to 5,000 times stronger than your brain, according to recent research.
Right, so they're broadcasting.
Exactly.
In a very real sense.
So, and my family, we knew this as a fact. We could walk into a room of 500 people and fall in love with the nearest alcoholic or alcoholic system in less than 5 minutes, and you could count on it. And
wow,
the reason,
you guys were good.
I'm telling you, we were good, and some people are faster than I am, but we had a father that was not alcoholic, but he was the youngest of 8, was the lost child, which there are two kinds of trauma, by the way. Level 1 is a single moment of encoding, T-1. Level 2 is when T-1 moments occur frequently and get together. They form an archetypal composite, like depression is an overwhelming cloak of heaviness, weight in the body, a large boulder in my shoulders or stomach area. So level 2 is a repeated pattern, like growing up with an alcoholic parent or a parent that's completely shame-based or alcoholic or dysfunctional. Well, my father was a completely shy, introverted person who couldn't express emotions openly or show affection easily as the lost child of his family. And so we had that 24-hour-a-day experience of a father that was very shy, good man, but very quiet, shy, and totally introverted, and didn't like to go out or travel much. The minute he arrived in a social setting, would want to leave and go home. And so having dealt with that, we could walk into a room easily and identify with the most repressed individual in a matter of minutes. So I know that our listeners, many of them know this experience of attracting a certain profile or pattern. I call it the shadow marriage. Frequently in the first marriage, we attract the worst of mom or the worst of dad or both until we get it, and then kind of reset our default in the heart of definitions, and then we attract healthier. But the discovery of those two meridians, I think, may have some bearing, particularly with breast cancer, as we learn more about this. So,
well, quick question for you, and it does relate to breast cancer, but to a number of other things, which is when you talk about the T-1 moment and how the body freezes trauma, what have you found as to where the body tends to freeze trauma? I know there are various locations, but if you had to group it by, you know, some people talk about trauma being stored in, say, your musculature, or others will say in various organ systems. What kind of mix have you found as to where trauma is actually stored?
Well, your body, somatic psychology would basically say to us now that your body is a three-dimensional holographic computer system. And honestly, there is not a part of the body where I have not found pathology stored. I literally, from your toenails to the hair at the top of your head, there is every single part of the body has hurt on certain individuals. And they have values. I have a map in my software where we're recording it, where I'll give you a quick overview, but your left brain linear masculine function tends to come out the right side. Your feminine, emotional, intuitive, three-dimensional perception comes out your left. So legs, for instance, support you in life. So I found that memories 0 to 3 years old, trauma from dad or mom, occurs from the base of your foot to the base of your ankle, 0 to 3. 3 to 5, the ankles, 5 to about 10, development of your musculature and bones in your shins, knees, teenage years 10 to 17, 17 to 23, top of the knee to the top of the hip. The hips represent your power transfer points, where you take what mom gave you in the left leg, dad gave you in the right leg, and choose your own self-direction by pivoting at your hips in your 20s, usually teens, late teens, early 20s. That's your power transfer point. So when these kinds of issues are compromised, there is not a part of the body where I have not had memories and recorded events of chronic pain or illnesses or inexplicable pains that MRIs, CAT scans can't explain, that are reflected at all of these sites. But like you said, the Chinese have known this for 5,000 years, I believe. You know, they see you walking, a Chinese physician will see you walking across the room and say, oh, you have a problem with your father when you're about 3 years old, and say, look, your right ankle has a problem. And I've had them do that. In Japan, if you ever doubted that memories were holographic, I had the emperor's physician's daughter attend one of my workshops and heard that she was great with reflexology. And she offered to work on me. I said I was very honored. She, oh, no, I'm honored to work on you, Sensei. You're my teacher. Well, she did reflexology on me, and it wasn't quite the same as we get at Miraval here in Tucson. But she pulled out a thing that looked like a knitting needle, proceeded to poke the various pressure points in my foot, and she hit one point, which apparently relates to the lung meridian in the left foot. And she said, through the translator, she said, would you please ask him if he almost died of bronchitis when he was 2.5 years old?
Oh, my.
And I was like, oh, my goodness, because that is exactly what happened. I had such a high fever, was packed in ice. My mother, who had had six previous miscarriages, she had three, then lost six for Rh negative subtype. She had the priest and the pediatrician spend the night in the room with me, and obviously I survived. But nobody knew about this, including this woman working on my feet. And she said, can I poke your ribs? I said, sure, poke whatever you need to poke at this point. And she felt my rib cage and says, yes, you have scar tissue between these two ribs from bronchitis at 2.5. And she knew where to look on the left side to find the scar tissue. And that's the point, accessing the whole. So the Chinese have known that memories function in a hologram-like manner. The Hindus, the pearls of Indra, where the nervous system is likened to a string of pearls, where each pearl reflects the entire strand, which is interesting because it actually is the school of Buddhist thought that influenced Denis Gabor, who gave us the calculus that invented the hologram. So indirectly, the Buddhist school of thought reflecting the pearls of Indra and so on actually may have led to our integral calculus that gave us the mathematics and the physics for the hologram. So it's coming around here that we realize that the part accesses the whole, which is the theory in physics. You know, and to this day, you know, now they found with NFL football players, they can look at your eye. Actually, I was asked to consider talking to the Canadian Football League about head injuries and the reframing of trauma, because they now can look into your eye and determine if there's been brain damage from football play.
Right.
And so on. So the eye can access the whole. You know, a Western physician to this day still looks at your tongue to access the system. Iridologists. As an addictions counselor, I can get certified to do auricular acupuncture, where the same meridians that you were talking about, you can apply needles to the ears and reduce cravings for various substances and enable a person to prevent relapse or stay in recovery by working with those meridians. So we know acupuncture is quite helpful, and many cancer treatment centers are now doing acupuncture as well as part of their regimen in treating cancers also.
Now, with speaking of cancer, with HMR and doing all the trauma work that you've done, what are some of the most powerful stories that you can relate that have to do with cancer and what you've actually seen and experienced related to cancer?
Well, I guess the first one, which really, it was a cancer patient that, in a sense, revealed the power of the technique to me. I was working on a cancer patient in the mid-90s here, and she had actually an environmental cancer. So she did die from that cancer. But she had had an exposure as a child playing near a waste dump, and she cut her foot in a stream, and apparently the chemicals that were in the water infected her system. So a couple of weeks later, her leg got infected, and she got a very high fever. And so by the time I met her, she was married to a person in the medical field also. So he was not into much with alternative healing or alternative therapies. And she, even though I was at Cottonwood Treatment Center and Dr. Andrew Weil was referring his medical residents to watch me work, and so I was considered part of the integrative wellness program or at the university as the observation portion of the clinic. Anyway, he was referring people there, but anyway, so this woman came to me while I was working there, and I placed my hand over the primary tumor site. It was throughout her body. It already metastasized multiple sites, huge tumor in her sternum. But what happened shocked me, because when I placed my hand over the primary tumor site, the pain left the tumor site, completely migrated to her right leg, which, as I said earlier, would be father. And she actually, I didn't know it then, but she actually went into a memory about her dad. And basically, to give you a quick summary, I said, how old are you? I'm 8. Where are you? At home. What's happening? My leg's infected. What happens then? And what we do with this technique is we keep asking questions until we hit T-1, which is the overwhelming feeling statement, which tells us what the trauma is and why the body is holding it and why it froze at that moment. Mm-hmm. And so I said, all right, you're 8. What happens then? My leg, well, I cut my foot near a stream bed. What happens next? My leg got infected. What happens then? I got a very high fever. What happens next? My daddy has to pick me up and run down the street with me to the emergency room at the hospital to get emergency medical care. And what happens then? And her T-1 statement shocked me. She said, I feel so sad because that's the only time I ever remember my daddy holding me. And so the message there was, uh-oh, unless you get sick, you don't get loved. Mm-hmm. So this is, again, how emotional trauma overlays an actual, even an environmental condition. So I said, if we could change this, what I said, you know, I said, anything happened after? No, I got care eventually, but I kind of numbed out after that. So I said, if we could change the scene, what would you see happen? Oh, daddy would be kinder, give me hugs, more love and attention, maybe get sober sooner. Can you picture that? Yes. What color frame do you see around that picture? I see blue and white. She moved the blue and white color through her right leg, and immediately I felt pain waves leaving that area of the right leg. The pain returned to the primary tumor site and then started mapping, I call it memory mapping, started mapping its way to the left side of the body, towards the stomach or gut area, at which point she kind of bent over to her left side. She says, oh, now it's on my left side. I said, yes, I can feel it's moved to the left. And I said, how old are you? How old are you? And she said, I'm 9. And where are you? I'm at home. What's happening? I have a very high fever. I'm sick with the flu. And mama comes home from work. What happens then? She has to pick me up, put me on a bus, take me to another hospital for emergency medical care. What happens then? And again, the answer surprised me. I feel so guilty about inconveniencing Mama when she's so tired. So on the right side, if you don't get, you know, sick, you don't get loved. On the left side, if you do get sick, you're going to inconvenience those you love. And I found that shame and guilt frequently lock in cancer or illness pathologies when you don't want to hurt other people, you don't want to inconvenience them, so the body-mind will hold on to those things. So you always have to reframe the shame and guilt components of illnesses that could make a person want to, you know, hold on to it to prevent another person from suffering. So I said, if we could change that, what would you see happen? Oh, Mama would just reassure me and tell me she just wants me to be well and happy and to not worry about it and just that she's going to be so happy when I feel better. Can you picture that? Yes. Or maybe not being so sick even. Can you picture that? Yes. What color frame? I see yellow, light green, and pink. And the colors that you see for your memory are absolutely unique brainwave frequencies, particularly in combination. So when she moved that through her body, again, the pain left. I could feel waves leaving her left abdominal gut region. It went back to the tumor site. Now, this is a woman with metastatic cancer, environmental cancer throughout her body, but every time I worked on her, she was completely pain-free for 2 or 3 days and did not require morphine. She said it was the only thing that she did that completely alleviated her pain, and that when she did the work, she was not requiring any morphine. If I did not work on her for a few days, she was on a morphine pump every 4 to 6 hours. And so that pretty much stimulated me to have to write the books, to publish the work, to talk about the technique, to train therapists. Because I said, if even with an environmental cancer, which I didn't have any direct impact on, I said, if the system becomes vulnerable, is receptive to memory reframing, because when you reframe a memory, your adrenals go down, your T-cells go up, you release natural endorphins and enkephalins, there is a possibility, but since I don't work in a cancer treatment center, I am not sure if this is a consistent outcome yet. That's one thing that we're beginning to dialogue with and considering talking to MD Anderson in Houston and some other treatment centers. There's a woman at Hadassah Medical Center working with cancer patients in Israel that wants to bring this work there. So we're looking at the fact that if we can, in fact, introduce memory reframing along with whatever the cancer source might be, there's a chance that we could give them some opportunity to boost the immune system significantly. And even if it is chemotherapy, radiation, other traditional methods are being used, we could certainly support the effectiveness of those techniques by boosting the immune system naturally.
Absolutely. One of the things you said, Keaton, for me, because you were talking about people who have the, you know, we're talking about the relationship between shame and the need to be somehow perfect, not inconvenience other people, that kind of thing. And one of the, in our research on cancer, one of the primary cancer-prone psychological profiles that we noticed was the person who perhaps too early in life has to take on too much responsibility, and is the person who feels they have to be perfect, they can't show weakness, they have to be there for others, no one's there for them, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And there's a relationship, then, you're saying, really between that, and it is related somehow to shame.
There is. Well, two things in that regard. I think perfectionism is one of the most insidious traumas because it means you never get white light, that you're never good enough. And like our anorexics, and I've made a few discoveries about eating disorders, about the weight that the anorexic believes they hold when the rest of the world says, are you crazy? What's the matter with you? You know, you're down to 80 pounds. How can you say you're obese? But their anorexic is right. They are, in fact, huge because the weight is in the meridians, and they do feel like they weigh 3,000 pounds because they are hypersensitized to the emotional weight of the meridians, its energy weight, which is why traditional medicine will never fully understand eating disorders without embracing energy psychology and the oriental, the meridian understanding, because in the meridians, weight is limitless. And as a result, you can have black holes, you can have planets and solar systems, mountain ranges in your energy field from responsibility or shame, like you said. Shame, according to some psychiatrists and research, is the heaviest, densest emotional energy in the system. It's like having a black hole in the body. There's no love, no safety. It induces, it's my emotion word for trauma, because shame is defined as an alienation of the self from the self. It's actually a fragmentation or splitting in consciousness. And when that occurs, tremendous energies are lost.
So when you have a shame-based culture, or a culture based on the transmission of shame and guilt,
exactly,
you're really crippling people emotionally from early childhood and setting them up for all kinds of both physical and emotional trauma.
Correct. You're never good enough. And the reason I say about eating disorders, 85% of the anorexics came from a perfectionistic parent. And so it's never good enough. You never get white light. It's never pretty enough, never smart enough, never adequate, never performing well enough. And so it's like being dipped in lead once a day. Never white light, always less than enough. And so the anorexic, when I began to feel their energy fields, and they were down to 80 pounds, convinced they weighed 3,000 pounds, they eat a little bit of food, that weight triggers the emotional, the meridian weight, and they are like panicked and on a treadmill for miles and miles every day. And so the weight is real. It's just not real in our traditional childlike thinking of physical weight. Mm-hmm. It's actually meridian weight. And I think in some ways that's more real. That emotional energy of that trauma is more real than the physical body. And, you know, we call it body dysmorphia, and we're kind of missing it. But it's the same thing. You can't carry that much weight in your meridians without being profoundly impacted. And the anorexic sees it as absolutely real. And they don't even see their physical body as we see it. They see and perceive reality through the weight of the perfectionism. So you're quite right about that. It can be deadly. I mean, never good enough, never adequate enough. And, you know, our self-esteem comes through, object relations theory says it's through mirroring. We're supposed to imprint white light from mommy and daddy, unconditional love, positive regard. But if we looked into the eyes of our parents and they themselves were, you know, I'm partly German, so it's perfectionism, workaholism, you know, perform, you know, and that's how you prove your worth and show your worth. Well, it's never on the order of being. It's always about, you know, performance and activity, mm-hmm. and it never matches up. So you're quite right about that. Shame is a tremendously powerful force for creating dissociation. And, you know, we estimate now that we go in and out of memory probably 15 to 50 times an hour, so that we, if we're triggering these shame-based memories or the critic within the subconscious, that hypercritical voice, then we're fragmenting, we're splitting when we go into that space, and we lose energy. You know, the single greatest impact for all of our autoimmune disorders, our health, our well-being, is the fact that we go in and out of trance 15 to 50 times an hour, so our adrenals are in constant fluctuation. And if you have significant trauma in your history, there is no question, but the single greatest impact on aging, autoimmune disorders, weakening the system, making it vulnerable to cancers, viruses, illnesses, is the fact, in fact, that we are going in and out of these alternate physiologies. We're changing physiology 15 to 50 times an hour.
Yeah, just that transition is a huge burden on the system, let alone the type of physiology you're moving into.
Exactly. So
in that case, and I don't want to dwell on this, but I, you know, given the history of the Western religious history, which we were both very familiar with, of course, from our backgrounds as priests, is that if you have a shame guilt based culture transmitted this way through the culture's religious system, you're really setting yourself up for a society-wide disaster.
Exactly. And that's basically in my books that I've been working on. I call it a huge paradigm shift from, and you know, I'm an addictions counselor, but I came to this with a 3 theology degrees and so on the background, but went into addictions. And I think there was a reason why I went into the addictions field, because until the 50s, the only model for dealing with drunkenness or gluttony was the moral failure model, like you and I were trained in the moral failure model. It's a sin. It's a moral choice. We have willpower. Well, addictions, the gift of addictions was it taught us that there's a physiology, a genetic predisposition. We know about THIQ, the heroin-like chemical that the alcoholic's brain converts alcohol into, which is actually more addictive than heroin, they found. So this THIQ, tetrahydroisoquinoline, in the brain makes the brain dependent on alcohol to make this heroin-like chemical. So we know now a lot about the physiology of this, and this is not a willpower issue. You cannot shame people. If you shame them about an addiction, they feel more of a failure and they're more likely to drink. So we discovered that shaming actually fostered addictions. So this moral failure model, I stopped in the 80s using any kind of shaming language about drinking or food issues and stopped using moral harangue to try to get people to change their behavior. So I said the majority of people really struggling with eating disorder issues and with alcoholism, it's an addiction issue. And so the gift was it caused us to look at the bigger picture, which is what's your family context? Is there a genetic history contributing to this? Where is it all coming from? And that led to the process which eventually gave me this technique and this kind of work, saying, well, what pauses and freezes consciousness and causes the greatest destruction to the psyche is when consciousness itself splits. You know, when that singular divine mind fragments into two, and that's every shame experience. A moral failure, like you said, is about behaviors and morality. Mm-hmm. But that model isn't going to work. I mean, we've seen it in the Catholic Church. I've done lectures for Catholic parishes about the priest pedophile thing, because, oh, Father's sorry for what he did. He's tearful, terribly remorseful. He's not going to do it again. Fine. Obviously, he's healed this. We can put him in a different parish. He won't do that again. Well, that did not work so well, because that's the five. They estimate your conscious moral mind is 5%. What you and I are working with in our focus and our effort is the 95% subconscious, which is in the body. And the body remembers everything. So if you have not reframed the memories, the triggers are still active, the triggers are still present. I worked with both victims. I was one of the therapists, one of the largest lawsuits settled against the Catholic Church in the United States, you know. And the fact is, it was a terrible case, a sociopathic individual perpetrator. And the question, the abuse, the trauma history was so extensive, but you have to deal with the trauma in the body, and the moral model doesn't hardly touch it. If anything, it aggravates it, because you're under the impression that by forgiving or releasing, discharging it, the trance is discharged or released from the body, and that was not the case. So until you reframe the memories, even putting the perpetrators in prison, even capital punishment, executing perpetrators doesn't necessarily touch the moment when you froze your trauma at a moment of abuse. So the importance, it does change a society when we learn to talk to the prisoners and heal the moment of abuse in their history so they don't act it out again. That's the goal. One of the goals I have is to get this kind of work into prison systems.
Well, sure, so you've cut down recidivism hugely.
Oh, exactly, because right now they have time on their hands. It's not like they couldn't be doing emotional reframing. But, you know, at this point, we've done the same thing with prisoners. I think Dostoevsky said the degree of a society's a measure of civilization is in how it treats its prisoners. And we do the same thing that we've done until now with our memories, out of sight, out of mind. You know, dissociate them, put them away, contain them. Well, that just is like a pressure cooker. It just does not resolve the issue. And
no.
So learning to talk to the moment of encoding can have a very profound effect on violence in a society, on pathology, on cancers, and so on. I mean, my goal is to get this to parents so they're reframing preventatively with their children before the third seven-year cycle. You know, your cells in your body replicate every 7 years. In fact, if you want to talk cancer, one of the leading breast cancer specialists in L.A., a Sikh physician, Dr. Saram Khalsa, was on the board for the research portion of the charity called Michael's Gift that I have. And one of his first questions when a new breast cancer patient shows up is, what trauma have you had from a male in the last 7 years of your life? And he says a huge percentage of women get tearful. The reason being, the cells in your body replicate roughly in a seven-year cycle. And so if something has changed to cause a lump in your breast to show up, he's going to look for trauma right away and see what kind of circumstance might have occurred to see if there is, in fact, a cause and a change in relationship or discovery of infidelity or abuse occurring or the awareness of the abuse, what's happened to possibly contribute to the weakening of your immune system in your heart chest area. And so we do have, you know, data coming in about that, and that seven-year cycle is a pretty significant event. If the cells replicate every 7 years, 7 years from the day a trauma is induced, all the cells in that area are going to be speaking red and black, so to speak, in that density. And I think it gets louder every seven-year cycle until it gets our attention. That's been my
observation. This is amazing, and what it also suggests then is a technique like HMR can be used preventatively or prophylactically in order to diffuse the traumas long before they turn into a physical symptom like cancer.
Exactly, and even sometimes when they have. I had a woman who heard my lecture at Miraval, and she was an artist, and she was leaving the next morning. She did not have time to work with me either in my private practice here in Tucson or at Miraval. And she told me that she had a lump in her breast at the time, was leaving on the early shuttle, could not work with me. But she, as an artist, said, I know my colors. And she went home, and she was scheduled for a lumpectomy for a malignant tumor. And she placed her hand over the site and started sending her healing colors, which she said were her colors, through the site whenever she thought about it, and several times a day. 12 days later, when she went in for the lumpectomy, the doctor came back and did some additional tests. And he personally walked back in and said, "I'm not sure what you did, but there's absolutely nothing here for us to operate on, that you're clear." And she says, "Okay, thank you." And she emailed myself and the general manager at Miraval and said, "Thank you so much, because I know that I healed my own cancer. I know I can do this. I know my brainwave frequencies." So if it is memory-based and it is not an environmental or genetic predisposition, perhaps even sometimes if it is, who knows the impact of color frequency on cells and meridians? We're just beginning the research piece to measure the actual impact and how your mind, this quantum mind that's supposed to be so powerful, could perhaps reprogram cells to replicate healthily. And I've seen it, I've done it with viruses and things on the outside of the body. But the inside of the body tends to be the turf of memory and trauma. And that tends to be you becoming your own medicine man or medicine woman in this lifetime and healing yourself. I mean, there are places, shamans, people go see John of God down in Brazil. There are external people, healers and trance healers that do tremendous work. But I think as a species, our goal really is the empowerment of the individual to access their own internal resources for their own self-healing and to raise the next generations with that ability so that we don't have to get sick in the first place.
The potential of all this is totally mind-boggling, really, when you think about it.
And yes, absolutely. And I think what we're unlocking is the fact that, you know, if people say, what does your work do exactly? I said, really, I'm teaching you to love yourself for a millisecond in your body-mind where you didn't store love and light, where you took in less than from mom and dad. And that's okay. There are no perfect parents. They all do their best with what they have. But by the age of 17, you and I have access to the colors for the reframing of all forms of memory. And if we can get to the body-mind and learn to talk to it, I'm playing with a couple of techniques now for trying to get cells to replicate healthily, nerve damage, blood cells. I have one woman I worked on recently that had a blood disorder, and we did 4 significant groups of memories. And when she went back for the blood test, there is no trace of this really rare, unusual blood disorder. It seems to have gone away. And she's vowed to follow me around, spoke in Chicago when I was there last about her physiology and her symptoms. And blood replicates every 2 to 3 weeks. So actually that is something that's hopeful, that if we can transmit a corrective signal. So I was working with having her use color to try to transmit a healthy signal to the blood cells, so that they could begin replicating positively. And I'm not entirely sure if that is what, in fact, might have caused the shift. But she reports now that she does not. The doctors are baffled. They can't figure out why she seems to have no trace of this really rare and usually unchangeable blood disorder. So can we do these things? I'm quite hopeful. We're still in the infancy with, you know, we're beginning the research piece now on this. But obviously, I've seen it, I felt it, and seen it successful over 100,000 times with my clients' memories. I've done 20,000 clients, at least 5 memories each. So we've done well over 100,000 memories, and every time a person reframes correctly, I feel pain leave the body, and I feel the body heat up slightly. So you have better energy flow, better meridian flow. So whatever illnesses, cancers, pathologies we have in the body, when we reframe this correctly, we're going to see improvement in our overall health. You know, and I believe we're also, like you said, my Living as Light book, we're light beings occupying a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just about getting rid of cancers and pain. It's learning to, as a species, to master consciousness, to master our states of consciousness. You know, you talk about cancer. So I'll give you the story here, is that my father died of what looked like a lung cancer. And he was in the hospital. And I scanned his lung while he was asleep, and I felt an ice-cold spot over the right lung. Now, my father lived, like I said, as the shyest, quietest man. He lived in moral fear of his kind of raging, angry father. And when I scanned his lung, I felt an ice-cold spot, and I do not feel purely physiological, genetic, or environmental cancer. So I did not think that this was coming from his chemical exposure. And it was on the right male side, so I said, you know, I think this is about the fear he lived in of his father, of male figures. And before he died, I mean, I worked with a healer at Miraval, and she said, oh, look, your father healed a lot of his issues in this lifetime. She said he didn't know how to heal himself, So he took all of his traumas, and he did the only thing he knew what to do, which is also very Catholic of him, actually, you know, suffer for others and the pain of others. Take it into your body and sacrifice what you can for the salvation of other people. But she said he did the only thing in his good faith that he could do, and it worked, but you pay a tremendous price. And she said what he did is he took all of his trauma history and he turned it on himself rather than harm another human being. And I said, that's absolutely true. Before he died, he had Parkinson's, diabetes, you know, and even diabetes. Deepak Chopra in Quantum Healing talked about the fact that he had people with multiple personality disorder, and one of the alters, they were insulin dependent, you know, they were not processing insulin properly and were diabetic, and in the other alters, insulin was back to normal processing. You know, and
right, so it's amazing how the body can actually shift its physiology.
Absolutely, and these shifts in consciousness can be huge.
Yeah.
So, you know, I felt this above his right lung, and I said, I don't think he's dying of just lung cancer. I think he's dying of a trauma related to his father or a male figure. Of course, he would never talk to me about that. The older he had before my father died, he had Parkinson's, diabetes, a colostomy for 26 years, two heart attacks, two head injuries, and now he had lung cancer. So when the healer said, oh, he didn't know what to do with it, so he turned it on himself, well, my mission in life was, I don't want to die as the victim of my unresolved trauma history if I can do something about it. And so part of my passion and the development of this work was there must be an easier way where we can learn to speak to the consciousness and learn to heal these things before they have to get our attention through cancers and heart attacks and head injuries and falls and imbalances and damage to the muscles in these parts of the body where I see trauma occurring. There must be a way to heal memory in a timely manner. And that was kind of the fuel or the passion for the development of my work, was partly seeing my father dying of all these things. And he did live with a colostomy. He had colon cancer for 26 years, and that one was environmental. But, you know, it's not taking away allopathic medicine. Allopathic medicine sort of saved his life with that one, you know. And so it's working in conjunction with. But if we don't do the emotional piece, it's like, I'm afraid, you know, he survived the colon cancer, but what about the emotional trauma from the father figure and so on, and his fear? You know, lungs are about taking in life, embracing life, you know, fully. It's how you step into the world. You take your first deep breath of air. And so when the lungs go, I was like, my goodness, and I know I was shy like my father, and so there was the bronchitis as a little child.
Interesting, because in the Oriental system, the positive emotion associated with the lung energy system is courage.
Oh, interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
So that fear piece, you know, in life and the restriction of breathing. Well, and with trauma, you know, the one mechanism that means, please, do, if you're out there listening, do yoga. Do some kind of breathing meditation. Breathe in your healing colors every day. And I'll tell
How
you this.
How do you determine what your healing color is, by the way? That would be a key question people would be
interested in. First one is, the easiest one is, close your eyes and picture a beautiful, safe place in nature, either real or imaginary. Then ask what your favorite color in that image is, or what color you would frame it with, and then breathe in that color. Breathe in or picture a waterfall. You can think it or see it. It doesn't matter. Your brain is still accessing. The part accesses the whole. And breathe that color through your body at least 50 times to anchor it in the subconscious, because you hear something 50 times, it goes into your subconscious. Then when you need it in the future, if you start breathing in that color, your body will go to that place even if your mind's not quite there yet. So it's a simple self-hypnotic technique. And you know what? The leading anesthesiologists in the country are now teaching you, before you go into surgery and immediately upon coming out, breathe in a color, your safe-seeing color. Breathe it through before you go into surgery, and as soon as you're coming out, start breathing that color, and you release the effects of anesthesia, the side effects, faster, and you come out of it more gently with, like I said, fewer side effects. So I thought it was fascinating. One of the anesthesiologists I was trained said, you're not going to believe this, but one of the top anesthesiologists in the country is using color before and after surgery to release the effects. Because I noticed years ago that I'd be working on clients and suddenly feel a very groggy, lethargic feeling in my body. And I said, wait a minute, have you ever been under anesthesia? And he said, yes. Well, anesthesia is kind of like when they try to kill you, but they don't quite go that far, but they put you as out of it as they possibly can, so you have no pain. Well, some bodies take that in as a trauma and store the memory of anesthesia in the body subsequent to surgery. So you have to reframe the anesthesia trauma to the body if you've been through a lot of surgery. So I say, what color would you move through your body to release the effects of anesthesia? And your body will often give you the color right away. And, of course, your color combinations, your colors you see are not my colors. So only you can do that for yourself. So using color, breathing color. I have a chapter in my new book I'm working on is like you're wearing your healing color. Because 50% of the time I find the clients come into my office wearing the color they're going to heal their worst trauma with. That they're actually
So your clothing can be a clue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is the color. If you're attracted to that color, you're healing yourself using that frequency. The color you painted your bedroom, your house, the car you're choosing, the vehicle through life, the color of your vehicle through life, often these things all reflect unconscious efforts to heal something. And so browns, beiges, tans are about grounding and safety. Pewter color is a knight in armor. You're defending yourself against boundary violations. Red is about power, passion, energy. A lot of sexual abuse comes in at orange, creativity, because that's the trauma to your creative center. So they're going to reclaim it through orange. A lot of artists will paint a lot with orange, especially if they've had trauma or sexual abuse. They'll be doing oranges and reds to reclaim their power. So unconsciously, we do a tremendous amount of healing unconsciously through the colors we surround ourselves with. And it's all about brainwave frequency. So there's much that we can do with that. Much that we can do. There's a whole field now developing called color psychology. And I'm working on presenting to the American Academy of Art Therapists or the community of art therapists because, you know, these breakthroughs in how to use color surgically to resolve a memory or the stored form of a memory, it's very important work. You know, it's not just having a child draw the picture of the event. It's having the child breathe the solution through the body at the end of the drawing in order to anchor it in the system.
When you talk about breathing in a color, by the way, do you visualize you? So you, I take it when you breathe in this color, you visualize the color coming in. Do you visualize the color flowing in through the nostrils or through the top of the head, or how do you do it, or does it matter?
You know, it doesn't matter. You can do. Some people say picture your body. You know, it's an illusion that we're solid. You know, we're mostly. What did they say? The distance between the nucleus of the atom and the first electron is roughly the distance between the Earth and Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a thing. So the atom is not a solid object at all. So what I'll say is if you like water, you're doing the turquoise water of Hawaii, then stand under the waterfall and picture it flowing through your body. If you're in your head too much, like I am sometimes, then you might want to do a fountain from your feet up, shooting and pushing out all your worries and anxieties. If you are, colors are wavelengths. They flow, they're frequencies. So if you could picture breathing in that color, some people I'll say picture under an MRI or CAT scan or running through your whole body with that color from your head down. And where the color disappears is maybe where there's a memory and you're not safe, but try moving your safe color to go to sleep at night to help yourself sleep. Move that color from your head down through your entire body. And let it move out your stress or anxiety. And it's very powerful. I can knock myself out almost anywhere now using the right color. I just have to ask, what color do I need to release anxiety or to help me sleep or help me calm down? And it's very effective.
One thing I've noticed just for myself is whenever I choose a new screensaver for my computer here,
right.
I find myself instinctively looking for photos, whatever, it doesn't really matter what the object or subject of the photo is, whether it's a person or a nature scene or an airplane or I don't know what, but what I'm always looking for, I've noticed this quite unconsciously, that I'm always looking for something with sunlight in it. It has to have sunlight.
That's interesting. Well, yellow, golden sunlight, that's relationships. And I mean, you're a tremendous networker, as it is, but relational connections, I mean, connecting the right people to resources for healing. Yellow is happiness, joy, healthy relationships. It's a color for joy and happiness. I also find yellow is the color used to heal nerve damage. So it's kind of like the network that transmits the strongest messages through the entire body. Is the color
yellow?
Okay,
that's interesting, because when I think of sunlight, I tend to think of it more as a white light than a yellow light.
That's interesting, because it is very close to yellow-white light, golden-white light. I mean, that's the highest frequency of light there is golden-white. at least in traditional thinking as we process it. The colors basically go black, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, white, and then the metallic whites, which go into copper, bronze, brass, pewter, silver, platinum, gold. But golden white, you know, there's a reason why Christ-like figures, Buddhas, messianic figures are depicted in gold, because it's a very high bearer of frequency. And so yellow golden light reflecting the radiant sun is more than just yellow. It's a golden, almost blinding white light. And that's a very powerful healing color. Any form of white light is wholeness and health. And so on. So
that's fascinating, because in some systems, in some versions of the Oriental system at least, the gold and the white light are seen as very, very close somehow, or analogous, or interchangeable.
Well, I used to tease people and say, you know, the most expensive diamond in history until recently was the canary yellow diamond. And I said, there's a reason why that reflectant, sparkling yellow-white light was so important. Although it's been replaced now, which is quite interesting. Talking about trauma and emotion, there's one diamond that's now more expensive than that, and it's $1 million a carat. And you'll never guess what the color is.
No, you're right.
It's actually the bubblegum diamond, and it's pink, which is the heart meridian, the feminine heart meridian. So it's about emotion, and the sparkling pink color is actually considered the most expensive. But if you look at where we're at as a species, because you said it earlier, like, my goodness, in the age of reality TV, the media is not only not going to protect you, that when Boston blows up, you're going to see the bomb go off every time you turn on your television. If you've ever had your own boundary invasion, which, you know, my newest book, Earth, Surviving Trauma School, Earth is trauma school. The minute you step into DNA here, you're stepping into 1.9 million years minimum of trauma in the DNA and the encodings and your parents' histories and the culture you step into, the society you're in. So we have a lot going on with that. And in the age of reality TV, they discovered with September the 11th, if they can show you an image of a boundary violation, like a plane flying into a building, and you've had your boundaries violated, you've been teased, you've been harassed, you've been blamed, you've been falsely accused of something by a teacher, you've been picked on by your brother, your parents said something hurtful to you. If you've ever had your boundaries violated and you have not reframed those memories, when you see the image of a boundary violation, your subconscious is triggered and your 95% is hooked. You're now in trance, because a trauma is a spontaneous state of self-hypnosis. The body goes in to protect itself. Well, the thing about holographic memory is anything similar comes up on TV and you're going to be hooked. You're going to be triggered. So it's hard to take our eyes off the screen once we're into that kind of light trance-like state. I heard a reality TV, a producer at Miraval once say, I love reality TV. It's like being hypnotized. And I said, that is exactly what it is. He didn't even realize what he was saying. But they realize their ratings go up when they can get people hooked, because it's kind of like you're watching it, but you're being the observer of it, as though it's playing itself out at a distance, which kind of in a weird way makes us feel better momentarily. What we don't realize, though, is that what we watch on television or observe is we're giving permission for it to be played out on the stage of our holographic projector, which is inside our physiology. So everything you watch on TV, you are physiologically recreating inside your system over and over again. Hence, the 50% of the population that's in hyperadrenaline production, producing too much adrenaline and weakening our immune systems. So then we see rises in autoimmune disorders, rises in cancers, things of that sort.
So we're really a society that's perpetuating this for ourselves.
We are.
And we don't even know this.
And we think it's entertainment, which is scary. Because if you've ever watched any or played, I tried playing a couple of the video games to see how far we had progressed, and they are so real, so three-dimensional now, that when you go into that space and it brings up fear or anger or the monster is coming after you, you want to grab a weapon, it really does bring up primal, visceral emotion that wants to be discharged. And I don't think that's a particularly healthy place for our kids to be. And also, the mind sometimes has difficulty distinguishing between real imagery and the creative imagery of the subconscious. That's how Gestalt therapy worked. So if we imprint something over and over in the subconscious, I suspect we're weakening our boundaries and making ourselves more susceptible for the potential for violence or for the Columbine kinds of things where kids just go ballistic in the high schools and can't distinguish boundary-wise between an internal emotion and externally acting that out. you know, if they've been acting it out internally. That's how the Russians won the Olympics in many cases for a long time, is they had them pick their Olympic athletes pictured winning the event 200 times. So when they went to actually do it in the subconscious, having done it at least 50, your 95% subconscious believes you already won the award. You already, you know, won the record. You broke the record. And so when they went to do it physically, they had already done it. So in video games, if you're playing out violence 50 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, playing it over and over again, you cannot tell me that our culture isn't going to be more susceptible to giving ourselves permission to act that out in a state of
really
rage.
But really, what it is exactly a negative, a perverse version, in the sense of the law of attraction.
Exactly. You're imprinting negatively, and you think it's fun because it gives you an adrenaline rush. Well, because it really is giving you an adrenaline rush. You're having a physiological reaction to an imaginary event, but it's producing actual physiological changes in your body. But because you think you can turn the game off, my concern is if it's therapeutically working as a discharge and you're only playing it out in holographic space, it might have a therapeutic value. I do that with the technique. You can blow people up in holographic space. You can express all the anger. You can shoot your perpetrator and not harm the hair on the head of an actual human being, but completely discharge the energy subconsciously. So the verdict's still out on if there's a therapeutic function for using that kind of thing positively, but I think it needs to be targeted to the exact memory for it to actually resolve something. So there's a whole question about whether there's a positive value in this or not. But I think we don't want to play that a lot and keep our adrenals going up and down. They're already going up and down 15 to 50 times an hour. I'm not sure I'd want to increase my adrenaline overproduction that much without it knowing that it was going to have an adverse impact later in life. So
yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, as you say, the journey, the jury is still out on that to some degree. Before we go, because we're almost at the end of our time here, Brent, but one thing people will want to know is where can they access more information on what you've got, and did you have something, a place you wanted to direct them to?
Sure. My website is same title as my first book, www.healingdimensions, plural, .com, and our charity for the research is www.michaelsgift.org. And we have a 501c3 for the research that's going to be going forward now that we have the software developed to record memory sequencing. And I'm at Miraval when I'm not here in Tucson in my private practice. My email is abunah, A-B-U-N-A-H, at comcast.net. And I can be reached there. I'm also, as you know, at the Energy Psychology Conferences in the United States this year in Reston, Virginia, in a couple of weeks, and also in Toronto. Every October, which are great conferences. If folks are not familiar with energy psychology and, you know, acupuncture, acupressure techniques, and things of that sort, I know you've familiarized them with much of this yourself. So it's thank you for your efforts in educating people about these kinds of things that are available. And, you know, there's a chance we may be doing a program show. I worked on one of the Dr. Oz producers recently, so we'll see if we're getting a little more exposure in the next few months in August or September. So stay tuned. You'll be hearing more about this work as we gently go public. It's just the migraine piece, the fact that the majority of migraines are relives of the original and with a couple of added scenes, means that we can often reframe migraines, many of the migraine sequences that are memory-based, and resolve that without having to do medications. But that is going to, as we said before, create some slightly distressed pharmaceutical companies. So we're moving forward with our research and the evidence-based research so we can provide this to people as a ready resource that you can do on yourself on a daily basis.
That's fantastic, and I think it's... the healing potential of this is quite incredible, and just the implications when we think it through are huge. So
they are.
Thank you so much for sharing this with us. Is there anything before we go, is there any last thing you'd like to share, either about HMR in general or cancer in particular?
I think, you know, illnesses on the earth plane are all about invitations to, as you and I have known in our love, passion for the spiritual, I think it's an invitation to learn to love ourselves and to embrace consciousness and our power to impact things. You know, what I say HMR is teaching you to love yourself for a millisecond where you didn't get it from others and discover that you have all the colors, you have the infinite resources of love, perfect love within yourself. It's about learning to access it and take the time to apply it to ourselves. And as Barbara Brennan said in her work, you know, physical healing is just a side effect. She said, spiritual enlightenment is always our goal. And I believe I'll just end with that.
I might not let you end with that, because one thing I'm very interested in is the relationship between spiritual enlightenment and the emotional healing piece itself. And what I'm beginning to sense, of course, is that you really can't have... You can't have the latter without having the former. You can't have spiritual enlightenment without the emotional healing piece.
No, of course. In fact, we get a little dissociative sometimes, and we'd like to stay at home and hide in the dark and be mystics, you know, especially those of us that are introverts. But the reality of it is, if you don't have permission for power, if you have trauma, sexual abuse, orange, you have no permission to survive, you don't feel empowered by your parents growing up. If there's no red, no permission to be powerful, there's not going to be any violet in the third eye. There's no purple without red. So ultimately, we have to deal with our survival issues. We have to deal with our angers. We have to deal with our fears. Because if we want to get to that indigo violet color, that purple, that intuitive frequency of the third eye, then we have to give ourselves permission to be powerful. And that's about opening to all the centers of the body. That means we can't shut down one or two and expect to still be spiritual when we don't embrace our power. So I think you're quite right about that. There is a huge correlation between emotional trauma. I used to do a spirituality group for a psych facility. And I didn't even go into the G word, God, or whatever their higher power was. Many of them were recovering addicts. And the Mormon Church, the Catholic Church, Baptist Church have all paid me for therapies at different times for their members, parishioners. And I did a group, and all I did was talk about how any form of emotional trauma, be it depression, be it anxiety attacks, fear, be it an addiction, which is a mood-altering chemical, which is away from your true emotions, be it a bipolar disorder, how as these things take over our chemistry or alter our emotional perception, they leave us with a feeling of estrangement from the spiritual. And what I said was, you know, you ask people what their top four most spiritual experiences are, they're going to say birth, death, an intimate relationship with another human being, and a profound experience in nature. Mm-hmm. And what connects those four things is they are the peak moments of emotional experience. And so when we are dissociated from our own emotional core, and what I said is our biggest trauma in our world, in the Earth School, is that we've been taught to be afraid of emotion, to be afraid of a feeling. We were taught that certain feelings were bad, or were dangerous, and in some cases in our families of alcoholics, they were. We had to be numb. So in alienating and dissociating from emotion and certain emotions being targeted and identified as threats, to the extent that we shut off those frequencies of our nerve centers, those colors, and it's quite interesting because when people reframe with a certain color and they put in blue or red or power and they reclaim their sexuality with orange, suddenly they'll open their eyes and say, oh, look, you repainted your office blue this week. I'm like, no, the office has always been blue. Like, well, why am I seeing it? I said, because if you shut that off within yourself, you can't find it or see it in the outer world either. We're blind to it because we've turned it off to survive. So exactly what you said is we embrace all of the emotions. The Buddhists may be true in the sense that they said, you know, all colors have a place, all emotions have a place in balance. So when we balance the reds, the oranges, the yellows, the greens, the pinks, the blues, the violets, we do get white light in balance. I mean, we are the white light. And that's the lesson, is that as we clear ourselves, there are times when I meditate and use color where I can't feel my physical body, I just feel energy. And it's wonderful, it's peaceful, and I know that all prayers are answered, and it's a place of absolute calm and peace, and everything is healed and whole and well at that moment in the eternal present. And I think that's what we're all capable of, is the mystic within each of us is capable of finding, I think the big lesson of HMR is that there's a part of us that knows perfect love. There's a part of us that knows what white light is. There's a part of us that can access that. Now, if we can access that and bring it into a memory, we can heal the memory. If we can heal enough memories in time, we don't have to have a Mount St. Helens and lose the breast or blow the top off the volcano or have a permanent physical healing crisis. But if we have, it's okay. It's just time to go back and reframe the memories that caused it so we don't get recurrence. And in the end, if we can learn to master all of these states of consciousness, something happens. I'm curious to see what the physical body becomes. I've never met a human being that I scanned that had resolved all of their trauma history. And
yes, and one thing I remember that I wanted to ask you about trauma history just very briefly is, because I believe you mentioned this once in a live workshop where I was with you, that we may not only be dealing with what we have experienced at the hands of, say, our parents or teachers or peers in this lifetime, but that also, and this comes, of course, from epigenetics, the whole idea that we may, in fact, inherit trauma histories from our biological ancestors as well.
Right. And, you know, whether, you know, we were raised in more traditional religious systems where we weren't supposed to believe in past lives or, you know, according to quantum physics, it's irrelevant what you call it. If you pick up, and I'm working on a client, if they go into a battlefield, I had a lovely Catholic woman who edits books for traditional Catholic writers, go into 8 violent deaths and memories in a single session. And they were more physical to my hands and her body than anything she knew in this lifetime. And at the end of it, she said, "What was that?" I said, "What do you think that was? I'm not here to judge it. I'm just helping you to reframe it and release it. I'm not here to impose any system of belief on what you do. This is body-centered, client-centered. It's you doing the work." I said, "But what do you think it was?" She says, "I'm not sure. Do you think it was my ancestors? Is it genetic memory? Is it past life memory?" I said, "Honestly, I don't know if we have the technology to answer that for you." But I said, "Did you need to reframe it?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Is your pain gone?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Then we have either an emotional obligation, I have as the facilitator an obligation to make sure that you've reframed that and to help, if possible, to completely release these things so that whatever that energy was, it was dense enough in my hands that it probably would have manifested as something in your body, an illness or whatever in this lifetime if you had not reframed it. It was so violent and dense, it was going to have an exigency." And I think some would say that's what karma really is. It's the unfinished energetic imprints of unfinished business. Now, whether it's, according to quantum physics, there are no past lives. They'd all be recurring either simultaneously, or maybe you're picking up a trace of it from your ancestors. And I've had some, that's another whole talk sometime, but how I've picked up trauma from the grandparent passed on to the mother through the violence, very violent grandfather, to physical abuse to the mother, to verbal abuse to the daughter, and I found the violence in the ear of the daughter that felt homicidal. And I couldn't solve how I could feel homicide in the auditory channel of a person until we took it out, piled it up, and the two people that showed up were her mother and grandfather. And when we just basically gave those energies back and asked their guides to help them, angels, their higher self, to help them heal their own stuff and their karma, their issues, that pain left her ear and was gone. And it was not her energy, but it was violent enough that I asked, was there a homicidal heritage in this family of any sort? Because to my hand, it felt like a murderous act, a violent event. But it was in her auditory channel. I'm like, well, obviously she wasn't killed through her auditory channel. You know, how could this be? So do those kinds of imprints get passed on? Yes. You know, the latest thing I worked on in the past few months is I was scanning a couple of clients, and 4 to 6 inches away from her head, I felt violence. But on the head, I couldn't feel any pain. And so eventually, I always trust my hands, so eventually I've learned to ask, were you ever near a violent act that could have imprinted somehow in your meridians or your energy field? I didn't even know what I was asking. And in both cases, you'll never guess what the client said.
No.
Oh, my mother said that when she was pregnant with me, my father got drunk and kicked her in the womb, in the stomach.
Yeah.
And the minute she said that, the pain intensified. And I could feel the blow. So I guess as a fetus in the womb, is your mother actually in a way a part of your body? Yes, she is. So when I felt it, it felt physical like a body being hit, but it was actually 4 to 6 inches away from her head. It wasn't actually on her head. So when you talk, when we talk about meridians and energy psychology, we're going to have to wake up and smell the coffee here, because the actual physically violent impact was several inches away in her energy field, because when she was in the womb and her mother got kicked, she encoded it as a physically violent act slightly off the physical body, which is why when I'm doing the technique, I always ask, is your pain inside or outside your body? But I had never expected trauma to the field to be stored and be lethal or dangerous several inches away from the physical body. We're just not traditionally conditioned to even think that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a second case occur about a month later where I said, would you please ask your mother? She says, yeah, I think my mother dropped me or something. Well, she checked with her mother. She says, mother's not quite sure, but she thinks she fell down the stairs when she was pregnant with me. And I could feel multiple kind of blow impacts, like as I was scanning her head mm-hmm. and feeling that pain. And I said, thank you for letting me know about that, because I'm pretty sure you're exactly right. So, I mean, anyone can learn to do what I do as you practice, as you, I still tell you, we're going to put you through training for free anytime you'd like, Simeon. So, anyone can learn to do what I do. I think in the ancient times we had some, the priests, the ministers remembered healing sciences. I think we knew what to do with our hands and how to do it. I think we've forgotten a lot of that and gotten very micro-focused on systems and structures and, you know, methods and ideologies, but we have sometimes forgotten the healing sciences. So I think it's going to come from the ground up. My goal is to have every person, every parent doing their reframing with their kids when they're younger, so it becomes actually just a way of life.
I think this is absolutely fantastic, and I look forward to your new book. And I also want to thank you for being so generous on this call with your time. And I know everybody who's listening has deeply appreciated it. It's been very profound content. So with that said, I think we've come to the end. But I would like to thank you very, very much for this. It's just been incredible.
Well, you are most welcome, and thanks for spreading the word and getting the information out there. So.
And thank you as well. Everybody, please join me in thanking Dr. Brent Baum for this incredible, incredible interview. And we hope you've enjoyed it. We look forward to your comments. And as Brent said, you know, he's given you his coordinates, his website, healingdimensions.com. Please feel free to go there, learn more, pick up a copy of his book, Living as Light. Look forward to his new book, which I think you said was Trauma School Earth. Was that the title?
Surviving Trauma School Earth. And I'm also converting all my books right now to e-books, so stay tuned. In the next month or two, they should be more readily available. So
fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for taking the time. And we wish you all the best, and goodbye for now.
Great. Thank you.